8 years later, and everyone had healed and moved on. Phoebe's parents had started a scholarship at Reed and Phoebe's high school in Reed's name. It was a large scholarship with elaborate requirements, and they spent many of their post-retirement hours administering it. "Keeps me busy," Phoebe's father said. Domino was in fourth grade, living with Ellen Page and her new husband, Randy, whose wife had been a restaurant manager at Windows on the World. They met at a support group. It was only Phoebe who was stuck in an acrylic box. She could see out, but she was alone, untouchable. It was the drugs. Phoebe was on antidepressants, pain medication, and sleep aids. She had the drugs that Dr. Field liberally prescribed, and she had black market drugs that she got from Brandon Callahan, Reed's roommate at Wisconsin, who was a drug rep with, well, Phoebe was hesitant to name the company that Brandon worked for. It was a big company. The drugs were good. There were those people, Addison, Phoebe's mother, and to some extent Delilah, who felt that the drugs were harming Phoebe, killing her even. Look what they had stolen from her already. Her consulting business had gone under. Her body, once fit and toned, was now a bunch of twigs with skin hanging off them like cobwebs. And her personality had vanished. She smiled once a month. She never cried. She never laughed. She had, however, become an excellent listener. Listening was something she could do. Many times the drugs made her feel lofty, like she was floating on air above everyone else, a Buddha on a pedestal, a deity calling in from the clouds. She gave sage advice now. Everyone, meaning Delilah, said so, because she had no ego. She spoke only the truth because she no longer cared. Addison and Dr. Field had tried to get her off the drugs. They wanted her to cut back with the eventual goal of quitting altogether. She could see their point. They would wean her off a little at a time, the way one treated frostbite. You warm the feet gradually by rubbing, and the blood returns, the tissue pinkens and comes back to life. This was how it would work with Phoebe. She would go off the drugs and things would come back into focus. She would get an appetite back. She would return to the gym. She would take on a small consulting project or agree to chair a brunch for donors to the Athenaeum. She would agree to take tennis lessons with Delilah. She would shop for a dress or a belt. She would be able to watch TV, make love to her husband, bite into a peach, take a swim on a hot day, read a magazine, and enjoy it. "Life is out there waiting for you," Addison said, with Dr. Field nodding beside him. Addison sounded like a TV evangelist, a motivational speaker with a best-selling book. Phoebe understood that Addison was right. Life was waiting for her. She could see it through the clear walls of her box. But she didn't want to give up the drugs. The drugs were Phoebe's life support. They were the bubble wrap that kept her from breaking. Reed was dead. He was never coming back. She would never see him again. Even now, 8 years later, that fact took her breath away. It was the vertigo. She was falling. Life was out there waiting for Phoebe, but it was not waiting for Reed, and therefore Phoebe would not, could not take advantage of it. This seemed childish to the rest of the world, but that was because the rest of the world did not understand what it was like to have a twin like Reed. Phoebe remained locked in her museum case, labeled Twin Sister of September 11th Victim. Phoebe lay against Delilah, absorbing her sadness. Delilah was rocking and rolling with it. She was hot and heaving. Her grief was pornographic. She was showing Phoebe the raw, pink, gaping, oozing parts of herself. Tess and Greg were dead. Phoebe had taken 4 Ativans between the time Sophie had told her the news and the time she reached the galley to tell Addison. The drugs were clothing her now, covering her like a protective suit. The fascinating thing had been her exhibition in the restaurant parking lot. She had emoted like a regular person, screaming, yelling, crying. She had been convincing, even to herself. The chief. The call from Danny Brown, the medical examiner, came while the chief was standing behind Finn at the mirror, doing his necktie. The funeral was in an hour. Andrea was with Chloe upstairs. The hairdryer was droning. Andrea wouldn't have heard the phone, and so the chief answered the call, leaving Finn's tie dangling, despite the fact that Andrea would have said, "Now is not the time, Ed." He had to know. "You're not going to believe this," Danny Brown said, which was not what the chief wanted to hear. He had been hoping for a glass of cold water, clean and transparent. He didn't want murkiness. He didn't want a goddamn detective story. He didn't want something he wasn't going to believe. And yet he'd had a feeling. Two people trapped under a boat, unable to grapple for the edges or swim until they were free of it? His blood alcohol was at 0.09. Hers was at 0.06, but she was on other junk. Other junk? Opiates. Your normal cause for finding opiates of this strength in the blood is heroin use. Finn stood morosely at the mirror, staring into his own freckled face, which looked exactly like his mother's, and then, noticing the chief's gaze, he fingered the limp tie around his neck, as if wondering what to do with it. "Now is not the time, Ed." Andrea was always right. "Send a copy to me at the station. In a sealed envelope, please, marked confidential. Do you understand me?" "Yes," Danny Brown said. "I mean it," the chief said. The chief did not like to pull rank, but in this instance, he had no choice. "No one else will see it," Danny said. The church was filled to overflowing. The chief had ordered Federal Street closed on the block the church occupied, between Main Street and India Street. People spilled out of the church onto Federal Street, and then around both sides of the church like an apron. The chief would have said he knew everyone who lived on this island, but he was wrong, apparently. Outside the church were groups of high school students. These were the girls from the singing group and their friends, and Greg's guitar students. They were easy to pick out, with the long hair and the look of discontent. The chief knew many of them, recognized others, but that was because he had two kids in high school himself. Casey and Eric's close friends had taken seats inside, but these other kids, the chief could not, in his present state, put a name to a single one, either did not feel worthy of a seat inside or liked the freedom of remaining outdoors. There was another group, young mothers and fathers with small children. These would be Tess's kindergarten students and their families, past and present. There was a whole generation of parents bringing up kids on this island who were strangers to the chief. Did they know who he was? He supposed they did. All in all, the chief estimated, there must have been 1,000 people. It was hotter than Hades. Bright and sunny, without a trace of the wind that had capsized Greg and Tess's boat. The island was teeming with tourists. At the edge of Main Street, there was a clear delineation between those vacationing and those grieving. The summer people wore their Lily Pulitzer prints and carried lightship baskets as they shopped for hydrangea bouquets. The locals were somber and subdued, wearing a depressing amount of black. Nearly all of them were weeping behind their sunglasses. The chief was wearing civilian clothes, a black suit bought for civilian funerals. He was working, too, trying to supervise crowd control. This would have been easier in his uniform. And teaching his summer cops, who had been on the job exactly 9 days, which street was India and which was Federal. The hearse was parked in front of the church. The chief was to be a pallbearer in addition to everything else. It might have been easier to delegate someone to take his place, but Andrea insisted that he carry Tess into the church and then again to her grave. He would do it. Once the service started, things were easier. The chief and Andrea were up front with Casey and Eric, and Delilah and Jeffrey and their boys, and Phoebe and Addison. Chloe and Finn had asked to be allowed to sit in the very first row, all by themselves. "You're sure?" the chief asked. Nods. Then, from Chloe, the self-appointed spokesperson, "We're sure." Those two kids were wiser and more composed than many of the people sitting behind them. They were holding hands, again, it seemed, at Chloe's insistence. Finn was wearing khakis, white shirt, navy blazer, and navy tie, the exact outfit he had taken his first communion in 2 months earlier. Chloe was wearing a navy sailor dress which she deplored, her word, used this morning with Andrea. It was her parents' funeral. She was supposed to wear black. But her closet revealed nothing black except a velvet Christmas dress two sizes too small, and so Andrea had steered her toward the navy sailor dress. There were, predictably, tears, and a lot of misplaced anger directed at Andrea, but Andrea had emerged from her cocoon of despair to deal with the kids, especially Chloe, with kindness and patience. Chloe put on the navy sailor dress, and as consolation, Andrea allowed her to carry a black sequined cocktail purse. The result, in Andrea's words, was part Shirley Temple, part Coco Chanel. In the purse, Chloe had put Tess's broken red sunglasses with the white polka dots, Tess's gold cross from her confirmation at St. Eleanor's in Dorchester, a package of Kleenex, at Andrea's suggestion, a chapstick, a copy of the picture of herself and Finn that she had slipped into Tess's casket, and a copy of the letter she had written for Tess, ditto. Nothing of Greg's. She'd put nothing in Greg's casket, and neither had Finn. Andrea must have noticed this, but did not comment on it, and the chief followed suit. Both kids had been very attached to their mother. Greg had been a good father, though he had complained to the chief and everyone else that Tess loved the kids so completely that there was no room for Greg to parent them, except around the edges. He played lullabies for them on his guitar. He read them Harry Potter. Though Tess disapproved, she thought it was beyond them and scary to boot. He helped them do flips off his shoulders at the beach. He took them to the Scarlet Begonia, where he bought them a lunch of cheddar potato skins and Coke. Tess complained to Andrea and everyone else that Greg was less like the twins' father and more like some prodigal uncle just returned from following the Grateful Dead, who showed up to break the rules and disrupt routine. Tess and Greg had had their battles, just like everyone else. And now here they were, in caskets, side by side, as the organ played the processional hymn and the ushers checked each pew for empty space. Could they squeeze in one more person? The church was like a cineplex during the 8 p.m. showing of a blockbuster movie. A ripple went through the church. The chief did not like ripples. A ripple meant an assassin in the crowd. He craned his neck. April Peck and her mother were headed down the left aisle. Andrea dug her fingernails into the soft underside of the chief's thumb. Delilah groaned. Even Phoebe pursed her lips and shook her head. April Peck was wearing a denim halter dress, as though she were ready for a day at the Hyannis Mall. Her mother, Donna, wore a black floral caftan that flowed to her ankles and a black scarf wound around her head. The chief did a double take. Donna had lost all her hair, it looked like. Cancer? This was a momentary distraction. The chief could not believe the girl had had the guts to show up. What exactly was she trying to prove? The chief had half a mind to escort the little minx right back out of the church. She could stand in the street, where Greg's other students had gathered. April Peck thought she was special. She thought she deserved a seat inside. Had the mother not been wearing that headscarf, the chief would have made a move. The priest reached the altar. In the name of the Father? Everyone genuflected, but not the chief. He had been raised a Unitarian and did not love all the high church rigmarole, the hands, the prayers, the responses that everyone else seemed to know. "A light has gone out," Father Dominic said. "Two lights. It is a beautiful day of sunshine, but we spend it in darkness." The chief tried to concentrate on the service, but then, too, he wanted to monitor the twins. All he could see of Finn was an inch of pale neck caught between the straight line of his summer haircut and the starched collar of his shirt. Chloe turned frequently to whisper to him, though Finn did not react. What was Chloe saying? She had developed a fearsome personality already. She was quick and clever, polite with adults, bossy with her brother. The chief smiled. The twins were an example of the miracle of life. They were healthy, intelligent, complex human beings. But for so long, they had been nothing but an idea, a yearning, a project, a wish helped along by the daily lighting of candles and a prayer chain. Tess had lost 3 pregnancies, one of them in a terrible accident, well into the second trimester. The twins, when they arrived, were a gift, and Tess never let herself forget it. The priest finished. Delilah stood to give the readings. Andrea did the prayers with a stiff upper lip, and then Jeffrey rose to do the eulogy. The church was silent. Jeffrey had the bearing of Abraham Lincoln, tall, lean, stately, and he was an orator, too. That was a Cornell education for you. Jeffrey talked about meeting Tess for the first time when she was 15 years old, a sophomore at Boston Latin, and so naive about the world that at dinner that first night, while helping Andrea set the table, she put ice cubes in Jeffrey's beer. The church laughed. It was so Tess. Even at 35, there had been things she was so naive about. April Peck was in the church. The chief, who liked to know where his sniper was, had her pegged in row 9. Danny Brown had found opiates in the blood. Tess shooting heroin? This was impossible. There was a mistake with the tox report. The night before, the chief and Andrea had gone through the Coast Guard bag. Andrea took the broken sunglasses for Chloe and Tess's flip-flops for Casey, but they were way too small. Together, they asked Eric if he wanted Greg's guitar. There had been a period of time when Eric was keen for Greg to teach him to play, but Eric said he wanted to think about it. When Andrea saw the macaroons still watertight in their Tupperware, she burst into sobs. The delicate emotional business of going through the personal effects ended then and there. The chief pitched everything else, except for the guitar and the overnight bag. There was a whole house full of stuff to be gone through and the will to administer. Addison had been named executor back in 2000, when Greg and Tess bought their house. The will had been written before Chloe and Finn were born and had never been updated. Never been updated. No guardians named. This was an egregious oversight on Greg's part. It was one of a million loose ends that would surface, the chief was sure, once the man's life was examined. Andrea was adamant about taking the kids. Tess's brother Anthony agreed, saying, "You were not only her family, you were her best friend." And heaven help the poor soul now who tried to take those kids away from Andrea. As the chief was dealing with the remains of the personal effects, he noticed that the Ziploc bag with Tess's iPhone was missing. He rummaged through what he had already pitched into the trash, thinking the bag might have gotten mixed in accidentally. He didn't see it. He checked through the overnight bag, Greg's boxers, the black lace lingerie thingy of Tess's, toothbrushes, hairbrush, polo shirt, khaki shorts, Noxzema, Advil. No phone. What had happened to the Ziploc? The chief checked the mudroom. His family stowed every last pair of shoes they owned in there, so in total maybe 50 pairs of shoes were jumbled in baskets that Andrea bought from Hold Everything to contain the mess. The chief sat down and dutifully emptied the boxes of shoes. Nothing. And then got on his hands and knees and checked under the cast iron radiator. Nothing. He checked the trash again. Okay, the iPhone was gone. Someone had taken it. Andrea? She had been avoiding the bag of personal effects as if it contained the Ebola virus. So no. Casey or Eric? It wasn't impossible, but both Casey and Eric had been quiet and introspective since the deaths, and considerate of their mother. They wouldn't have removed anything from the Coast Guard bag without asking. Chloe or Finn? Chloe, maybe. She was 7 going on 17. But was she sneaky or curious enough to lift her mother's phone? There had been people in and out of the house for the past 5 days. It could have been anyone. the cell phone. Jeffrey was still up there talking, now about Chloe and Finn, and how it was the responsibility of everyone in the church to raise them into adults and remind them each and every day how much their parents had loved them. Amen. There wasn't a dry eye in the house, including the chief's own. He pulled out a handkerchief. He had the summer cops outside to worry about, and opiates in Tess's bloodstream, and two more children to raise when his own two were nearly out of the house, and a wife who would hit the anger stage of grief prematurely if April Peck and her mother dared to show up at the reception. She would attack like a Siberian tiger who hadn't been fed in 2 weeks. And the cell phone, 5 calls from Addison in half an hour, was missing. But the funeral was almost over. Those caskets were going into the ground. It was unspeakably sad and awful and unfair, and the chief was going to shed a few tears. He deserved it. Phoebe. She couldn't make herself cry during the funeral, no matter how hard she tried. She was rummaging for anything, even horror. After all, the dead bodies of her friends, Tess and Greg McAvoy, were moldering in those caskets. But no, nothing. If she had feelings, they were shriveled and cold, hiding in a dark corner somewhere. The recessional hymn played. Phoebe caught a glimpse of Chloe and Finn from the side. Finn was crying, and Chloe had her arms around him as if he were her child. She was whispering something. Phoebe watched her lips. She was singing the hymn, "And I will raise you up on the last day." Phoebe was rapt. Something inside her peeled back, revealing. In another second, the priest would head down the aisle, and the caskets would follow. Phoebe got out of her seat. She scurried over to Chloe and Finn. She said something, inaudible to her own ears over the organ and the half-hearted singing, but Chloe and Finn seemed to hear her. They seemed to understand. They were nodding. They understood her, really understood. Phoebe could see it in their eyes. "You still have each other," she'd said. "You still have each other." Jeffrey. He had given the eulogy because that was what had been decided on by the group. He said the group, but what he really meant was Andrea. Andrea had the final word on all things Tess and Greg related. Andrea wanted Jeffrey to do the eulogy. He did the eulogy. Now, as they were filing out of the church, Andrea approached him again. "I need your help." Something other than delivering the eulogy? Something other than serving as a pallbearer for Greg's casket? "Anything," he said. "I need you to make sure that April Peck does not come to the reception." Jeffrey had already received an earful of April Peck-inspired invective from Delilah when the girl and her mother had entered the church. "Little slut. What makes her think, I mean, Jesus, she has to know she doesn't belong here. She is the last person. All the lies she told, the heartbreak she caused. And I'm not only talking about Tess, I'm talking about Greg, too." Jeffrey had shushed her, to which she'd hissed, "You are not my father." Now Jeffrey made a pained face. "I can't have her there," Andrea said. Despite her grief, or maybe because of it, Jeffrey thought Andrea looked especially beautiful. She looked 25 years old, not 44. Her face was thin. She was very tanned. What exactly was he supposed to say to April Peck? On the night that Andrea had asked him to do the eulogy, she had told him, "You always know just what to say." And everyone, except for Delilah, had agreed. "I'd have Ed do it," Andrea said now. "But he's, oh hell, he's busy being the police chief." "Okay," Jeffrey said. Andrea said, "Thank you, Peach." Which was what she used to call him, 20 years ago. "No problem," he said. He found April Peck and her mother, Donna, talking with Mrs. Parks, the former police dispatcher, who had to be 80 years old by now. Mrs. Parks, it seemed, had mistaken April and Donna for McAvoy relatives. April a niece of Greg's, perhaps, or Donna a cousin. Jeffrey loitered awkwardly at the edge of their conversation, waiting for April and her mother to separate so he could do the dirty business of letting them know they would not be welcome at the Westmore Club. Jeffrey wasn't sure if April Peck knew who he was. Would she know that Jeffrey and Greg had been friends? Obviously, he had just given the eulogy. He didn't realize the kind of celebrity this would temporarily lend him until April's mother stepped out of the chit-chat with Mrs. Parks, touched Jeffrey's arm, and said, "You did a wonderful job." Jeffrey was flustered. How to respond? "Thank you," he said. He had Donna's full attention now. Mrs. Parks had moved on to someone else, with April standing at her mother's right elbow. "Listen, I don't know quite how to say this. I came out of respect for Mr. McAvoy," April snapped. She was just a floating head over her mother's shoulder, blonde hair upswept, mascara appealingly smudged, transparent pink lip gloss glistening. April Peck was a knockout. That was the problem. "Yes," Jeffrey said. "Thank you." He let this expression of appreciation rest for a moment before he continued. "But because of the difficult situation, last year I mean, the family has asked that you forego attending the reception. They feel your presence would be inappropriate." Donna seemed truly astonished by this statement. She took a stutter step backwards, narrowly missing colliding with Mrs. Parks behind her, and her black headscarf slipped, revealing her bald scalp. "I'm sorry," Jeffrey said. "It's just that it's difficult for the family." "It's difficult for me," April said. "He's dead, and I want to pay my respects. You think I don't know my presence is inappropriate? You think I didn't feel 1,000 eyes on me? Of course I did." April's voice was loud. Her mother's expression was one of horror, but whether that was because of April's outburst or because of her own exposed scalp, Jeffrey could not tell. He was grateful that the church was emptying out. He didn't want a scene, and he was sure Andrea didn't want a scene either. But what had she expected when she had sent him on this mission? "Okay, listen," he said. "And for the record, you can't actually keep me out of the reception." "Well, it's private." "Well, I don't want to go anyway. I never had any intention of going. My mother is sick." Donna, meanwhile, had made her way unsteadily to the back of the church and was standing in front of the rows of candles, as if debating whether or not to light one. "I'm sorry to hear that." "She has cancer," April said. And since her mother was out of earshot, she added, "The chemo may not work." Jeffrey nodded solemnly. The unfortunate truth about April Peck was that she had lost all credibility. "And one more thing," April said. She took a step toward Jeffrey. She was officially too close. God, if Delilah saw them, she would have a conniption. Jeffrey didn't want to know one more thing. He had done his duty. April Peck would not come to the reception. Now all he had to do was get out of the church. But April Peck was not willing to let him go. There was something she was determined to tell him. She was so close to him, he could smell her breath. Bubblegum. Her sooty eyes were narrowed. She was going to have the last word. "I was with him the night before he died." Delilah. Delilah hated Andrea Kapanash. Hated her. She may have hated Andrea for years, but had only now, with the event of Tess and Greg's death, admitted it to herself. How could she hate someone she was such good friends with? It was all of a sudden obvious. Delilah hated Andrea because they were such good friends. Because for years she had spent hours and days and weeks in Andrea's infuriating presence. Andrea always had the answer. Tess had been Andrea's handmaiden, eager to please her, eager for everyone to please her. And so, for the years that they'd been friends, Andrea had controlled everyone's lives. Andrea was always right. She was the oldest. She had raised her children first. She could tell you how it was done. Andrea was married to the police chief. That gave her power, 2 feet firmly planted on the moral high ground. But now Tess was dead, and certain things were going to change. For starters, Delilah was going to express her true feelings about Andrea. Or maybe not. The fact of the matter was, Delilah was great at articulating anger in her mind, but in real life she found confrontation difficult and unpleasant, especially with women. Delilah had never argued with Phoebe or Tess, and she had never overtly argued with Andrea. Disagreed strongly, maybe, but Andrea had steamrolled her every time. Delilah had no problem fighting with Jeffrey. All they did was fight. She'd had no problem fighting with Greg, either. They had had a fight the night before he died. A fight that she couldn't bear to think about. Delilah was hosting the reception after the reception, which meant the six of them and the four younger kids. She had a bowl of chicken salad, a platter of cold cuts, slices of watermelon, a big bowl of potato chips, and a blender full of stiff daiquiris made from the strawberries she had picked at the farm with the kids. The food was the same as always, the drink was the same, the setting the same. Her back deck with the two chaises and the six Adirondack chairs, the croquet wickets set up in the lawn, the mermaid fountain gurgling, the cosmos and snapdragons blooming, butterflies and bumblebees hovering. But of course, nothing was the same. Delilah found herself unable to put on music. Music would remind them all of Greg. Would they ever be able to listen to music again? Addison had turned down her offer of a strawberry daiquiri and joined the chief in drinking Jack Daniels over ice. Addison was already quite drunk. They were all quite drunk, like characters from a Hemingway novel. Andrea was in a Chardonnay stupor. Phoebe was nursing a daiquiri, which she had topped off with more rum. Delilah was practically reeling from the daiquiris. In addition, she had had 3 glasses of Pinot Gris and, stupidly, a dirty martini at the Westmore Club. Jeffrey was drinking beer and was probably monitoring how many he'd had over what time period. But upon closer inspection, Addison was the worst of them all. He was muttering nonsense into his drink, his glasses were slipping, his hair, the fringe around the edge of his scalp that he claimed as hair, was mussed. All of his usual Princetonian deportment had flown away like a flock of birds frightened at the sight of him. "No one's eating," Delilah complained. She picked a chip out of the bowl, but couldn't bring herself to eat it. "I don't know why you went to so much trouble," Andrea said. "We all ate at the reception." "Or you could say thank you," Delilah thought. But instead, she decided to step on Andrea's shoulder and go over her head. "Chief, would you like a sandwich?" "Sure," the chief said. The kids were down in the basement, watching Cars for the umpteenth time, despite the fact that it was a beautiful evening and wouldn't get dark until 9. Delilah had even given them free run of the PlayStation, but they said they didn't want to play. "We just want to be quiet, Mom," said Barney, Delilah's 6-year-old, in a way that killed her. The usual rules didn't apply. The world was upside down. Her kids didn't want to play PlayStation. Addison wasn't piling Delilah's chicken salad onto a baguette. There was no music. Delilah sidled up to Andrea and lowered her voice in a way that indicated intimacy between two women friends. "There's something I want to talk to you about." Andrea was having none of the cuddly stuff. Her eyes, when she turned to Delilah, were bright blue and cutting. Her face was a shiny, impenetrable force field. "What is it?" "I'd like to take the kids for the summer."
"The kids?"
"Chloe and Finn."
"Out of the question."
"Now, see, who said things like that?"
"Hear me out," Delilah said.
Andrea raised her eyebrows and pursed her lips in a way that made it look like she was whistling. Delilah tried to think back to a time when she had really liked Andrea. Well, when Drew was born, Andrea had come to the house and cleaned and done laundry and roasted a chicken. She had monitored Delilah's milk flow. She had reached right in and fixed the way Drew was sucking. She had pinched Delilah's nipple with gentle authority, as if she were a nurse. "Better?" she'd said. Miraculously, it was better.
The nursing didn't hurt anymore. Drew took in long drafts of milk. Delilah felt her breasts thrumming along like a machine. Better. Andrea had checked in on Delilah for weeks. She offered to babysit so that Delilah and Jeffrey could go out to dinner. She had, Delilah realized, filled the space where Delilah's mother should have been. Then there was the kiss, South Beach, 2005. They had all been at a dance club in the wee hours. Delilah was drunk on champagne and Andrea on vodka. They had both been eating cashews that they later found out were laced with ecstasy. Andrea and Delilah had been dancing on a stage with poles. It was fun and sexy, and although Delilah had very little memory of the details, she did remember that she had kissed Andrea in front of 300 writhing bodies, and the kiss had been passionate. But thinking about that now was only puzzling. Andrea could be fun. She could be kind and reasonable. Phoebe believed that when you had faith in a person, he or she responded by rising up to meet that faith. Okay, fine. Delilah would test out that theory. She would have faith that Andrea was a reasonable woman who would see that Chloe and Finn should spend the summer here. If Andrea wanted them in September, so be it. Just for the summer, Delilah said. I have the boys at home all day anyway. Finn is in the same camps. The kids are on the same schedule. They're best friends. I have all the toys, all the books, all the games, inside and out. We have the empty guest room where they can do air mattresses and sleeping bags on the floor of the boys' room. Like summer camp. It will be fun. They need to be with family, Andrea said. But you and Ed don't need 2 7-year-olds underfoot all summer. You were just starting to enjoy yourself. It's safe to say that enjoying myself is a thing of the past, Andrea said. Her nose reddened and started to run. It's over. Let me take them for the summer, Delilah said. You'll see them all the time, whenever you're here and any other time you want. Then, at the end of August, we can transition them to your house. One transition and then another, Andrea said. It will be too difficult for them. Think of the kids. I am thinking of the kids. You're thinking of yourself. You want to be the one who swings in on a vine and saves the day by taking in the orphans. Delilah's faith was gone. She was back to anger. I don't think of it like that at all. I was thinking of the kids, what would be the most fun for them. Fun? Andrea said. Yes, fun. There's nothing wrong with fun. They're 7, Andrea. They need to be with family. It was time for her big gun, her sure thing. But first she looked around. Jeffrey and the chief were out on the deck. Delilah had forgotten about the chief's sandwich. She panicked for a second, the panic of a waitress who'd neglected to put in an order. Well, she could get to it in a second. Then she checked on Phoebe and Addison. Phoebe was asleep, stretched out on the sofa. Delilah watched for a second to make sure she was breathing, and Addison was slumped in the club chair, still muttering into his chest like a homeless person on the street. Delilah said, "Why don't we ask the kids? See if they'd rather stay with us or with you." Ba-boom. She could almost hear the guns report, smell the bitter smoke. But Andrea did not surrender. She said, "Why don't we ask ourselves what Tess would have wanted? Would she have wanted the kids to spend even one night here?" Delilah laughed, "Ha!" and busied herself with making the chief's sandwich. She was stunned silly by Andrea's counterattack. Delilah had left herself open for this. Tess did not like the kids to spend the night at Delilah's house. She had always been funny strange about letting Delilah take the kids at all. Delilah knew that Tess believed the kids ate too much junk at this house. If you called freshly popped popcorn topped with freshly grated Parmesan cheese junk, they played too much PlayStation, though there was a house rule of 1 hour at a time, 2 hours if it was inclement weather. They didn't get enough sleep. At home, Chloe and Finn were in bed at 6:30, a fact Delilah found unfathomable. Tess basically let it be known, without actually saying it, that she did not approve of Delilah's parenting or the way Delilah ran her household. It was too freeform for Tess. There was too much left to chance. Tess had been extremely vigilant in the parenting department. Delilah had once watched her clean the inside of the twins' ears with a Q-tip soaked in rubbing alcohol. Tess did not allow the twins to eat food from the school cafeteria. She did not allow PG movies. But Delilah's supervision had been okay with Tess. It had been a complete lifesaver whenever Tess was in a jam. When she and Greg had in-service days at school and no one to babysit, who did Tess call? Did she call Andrea? No, she called Delilah. Who had Tess called when she and Greg had wanted to go on an anniversary sail with a possible overnight on the vineyard? She had called Delilah. Delilah rued her decision to allow Andrea and the chief to take Chloe and Finn out of here that first night. She should have held on. Possession was 9/10 of ownership. Delilah said, "Let me take them for the summer. Please, Andrea, I'm not interested in a custody battle. I just think..." Andrea said, "What about your work?" Delilah smoothed mayonnaise over the chief's bread in careful stages, as if she were painting a wall. "What about my work?" "You plan to work 4 nights a week, work late, and then come home and take care of 4 kids all day?" Delilah laid down slices of Black Forest ham, Genoa salami, Lorraine Swiss, hothouse tomato and baby mosh from the farm, roasted red peppers, a few thinly sliced marinated artichokes. Perfection between 2 slices of country loaf. Okay, so now Andrea was going to attack Delilah's job. Why not? Delilah's job was as embattled as the Gaza Strip. Jeffrey resented it. He thought it was beneath her. He thought it was shabby. Delilah was little more than a glorified hostess in his eyes. Her job was nothing more than a flimsy ploy devised to escape the kids and get free drinks at the end of the night. Delilah had stated her case again and again. She had been the dining room manager at the Scarlet Begonia for 6 years. She held the number 4 position, behind Tom and Faith, the owners, and Donaldo, the general manager. She headed the wait staff, she squared the bills, she tipped out Graham, the bartender, and the Salvadoran busboys. She made the deposit at the bank in the morning. She helped Donaldo sift through 90 or so applications when the college kids arrived in May, and she helped him fire anyone who didn't work out. The Scarlet Begonia was a vibrant year-round business. It made buckets of money, and Delilah was a crucial part of the team. "I'm thinking of quitting," Delilah said. Her head was spinning. She was drunk. One of the signs of Delilah drunk was that she disclosed pieces of classified information prematurely. She hadn't discussed quitting the Begonia with Jeffrey, nor with Phoebe, nor properly with herself. The thought was just floating around in her mind with sad inevitability. At the funeral reception, Tom and Faith had approached her together and told her to take as much time as she needed before she came back to work. They had been drunk at the reception. They were more or less always drunk or hungover, which was what gave the Begonia the whiff of disrepute among people like Jeffrey and Andrea. But Tom and Faith were good citizens, community people. They loved Delilah, and they had loved Greg, who had played the guitar there for over 10 years. Tom and Faith had, in their hippie, hazy, funky, freewheeling way, always treated Delilah and Greg as part of their family. They had also had the misfortune of being present for the fiasco that was Sunday night, Greg's last night alive. But Delilah wasn't willing to discuss it with them. She wasn't going to think about it. She looked at Tom and Faith. Tom with his gray ponytail and John Lennon glasses, and Faith with her signature rouge. Some days it was applied more evenly than others. Delilah had tried many times over the years to imagine Tom and Faith making love, and had failed. Likewise, she could not imagine herself ever working a shift at the Begonia again. Tom and Faith feared this, maybe, and hence were offering her lots of leeway, anything to keep the door open. If Delilah could just be honest with herself, she would say that for her, the Scarlet Begonia had always been about Greg, and Greg was dead. Andrea did not respond to Delilah's revelation. No surprise there. She just closed the book on the conversation by saying, "The kids will live with us. We're their family." Delilah cut through the chief's sandwich with her serrated bread knife and arranged it on a plate with a handful of chips. Jeffrey stepped in off the back deck and said,
What are you girls talking about?
Nothing, they said together, and Delilah was grateful. She had concocted the whole notion of taking Chloe and Finn without consulting Jeffrey. She was a horrible wife, and she was drunker than she thought. Addison's memory, in regard to Tess, went back only as far as the first time he had kissed her, December 27th, in Stowe, Vermont. He wasn't sure if he could go back and think about it. Well, wait, maybe. Give him a minute. It was sort of like asking him if he could go down and touch his toes now that his femur was broken. But then it occurred to him that all he had left of Tess were these memories, and since no one knew about their relationship, there was no one in the world to talk to about it other than himself. It had crossed his mind to make a truly mind-blowing announcement at Jeffrey and Delilah's house following the reception. Why not just confess? Make a scene. But Addison loathed scenes. Even now, when he thought about Phoebe shrieking in the parking lot of the galley, he closed his eyes and breathed in deeply. Never mind the way she'd shattered like a teacup on September 11th. Addison decided not to come out with the truth for many reasons. And really, his distaste for scenes was at the bottom of the list. First of all, he didn't want to hurt Phoebe. Second, he loved his friends, and he wanted to keep them. And somewhere in there was another niggling reason. He feared that if he told everyone that he and Tess had fallen in love, no one would believe him. Why? Because Tess was married to Greg, who had muscles chiseled out of mahogany, a voice that fell somewhere between Frank Sinatra and John Mayer, eyes that made even Floribel, the receptionist in Addison's office, who was a lesbian, tremble with nerves and excitement so that she almost spilled her coffee every time Greg walked in. Why would Tess turn around and have an affair with Addison, who was bald and bespectacled, and who could not even get his own wife to kiss him with tongue? No one would believe it. They would laugh. In your dreams. But it had happened. It was real. They had all gone to Stowe on the day after Christmas for what was their sixth and final group vacation. Adults only, 5 days of ski and après-ski. Addison had gotten hold of the four-bedroom condo for free in the usual way, which was to say that a man who had bought a $5 million piece of land on Pocomo Point from Addison in the fall had offered the condo to Addison as a thank you for doing the deal. Addison said, "Oh, really, Jack, it was nothing." Jack said, "Take the condo. Week after Christmas, it's yours. Wife and I are going to St. Bart's." The group vacations were always fun. They were always the best. Though in Addison's mind, the best of the best had been Vegas, and every trip since had been an earnest attempt to live up to Vegas. This trip to Stowe was especially handicapped because of what had transpired between Tess and Greg. The whole mess with April Peck had been murderous. Addison had heard only Greg's side of the story. Tess would not forgive him. She would act like she'd forgiven him, and then either something would happen, she'd bump into someone at the grocery store who would want to vent their feelings on the topic, or nothing would happen. Out of the blue, she would just flip out. She would make Greg tell her the whole story again. She would get angry again. She would declare that she could never trust him again. She wanted him to quit his job. She wanted to move away. She wanted to move out. Still, they had agreed to the trip to Stowe. They asked Cassidy Montero, on Christmas break from her freshman year at Dartmouth, to babysit. Greg was gung-ho about the skiing in a way that made Addison nervous. Addison, despite his many other talents and accomplishments, did not ski. He liked the atmosphere of skiing, the fire-warmed lodge, the view of a snowy mountainside, the clean air, the drinks, but not the sport itself. Addison suspected that Greg's opinion of his own prowess was inflated. This was generally the case. But at any rate, Greg's enthusiasm fueled a sense of great expectation for the trip. So there they were, the eight of them, in colorful Gore-Tex parkas and snow pants, with probably 100 zippered pockets among them. The chief and Andrea had their own skis and boots, as did Greg, as did Jeffrey and Delilah. Phoebe had brought her ice skates and her cross-country skis and boots, all carefully preserved relics from her high school years in Wisconsin. The condo was located 200 yards from the parking lot of the mountain. It had two stone fireplaces, four sumptuous bedrooms, each with its own marble bath, a gourmet kitchen that Jack the client had, as a surprise, stocked with Swiss Miss and marshmallows, fondue cheese, exotic salamis, olives, white wine, champagne, and a handle of spiced rum. A deck with an 8-person hot tub overlooked the face of the mountain. From the deck, Addison could pick out tiny figures whooshing down the trails. The furnishings were Lux Lodge, suede sofas and deep armchairs, a coffee table fashioned from a tree trunk. There were two flat-screen TVs and a sound system with speakers throughout the house. It was impossible to walk into that condo and feel like anyone except the luckiest person alive. If the fluffy duvet sheathed in English flannel on your bed wasn't enough, if the deep shearling throw rugs under your feet weren't enough, it was as if there were fur coats strewn across the floor. Then step out onto the deck, where the hot tub was steaming like a cauldron. Take a hot buttered rum from the tray Delilah was passing around. Help yourself to a cracker topped with goat cheese and hot pepper jelly, and look at the mountain, while snow fell gently onto the shoulders of your spider ski jacket. "Are you happy?" Addison had asked Tess. He had asked her randomly, because she happened to be standing next to him. "Deliriously," she had said. Had it started there? Not quite. But Addison had been affected by that answer. Something had bloomed under his layers of goose down, Gore-Tex, cashmere, and 100% cotton. He had, via the unexpected perks of his profession, been able to make Tess, who had been sad and anxiety-ridden for months, deliriously happy. What had bloomed in Addison's chest was not love, but self-congratulation. It was a start. In the morning, everyone drank coffee, munched toast, grabbed bananas, or stored them in one of their many zippered pockets for later. Off to the mountain. The ski car, the chief's Yukon, was leaving. Phoebe would take the other car, her and Addison's Range Rover, up to the Trapp family lodge, where she would cross-country ski, get lunch, and have a massage. Phoebe had a little duffel packed with all her stuff. She had her boots hanging over her shoulder by the laces, and her hair was done in two braids, just like the Swiss Miss. "Okay," she said. "See you later." She looked fine, normal, happy. A woman out to relive the winter sports experiences of her youth and then indulge in the pleasures she had discovered as an adult. Addison would have been fooled had it not been for the tinny quality that her voice took on when she was medicated, as opposed to the pure, melodic silver of her actual voice, though Addison heard that sterling quality so rarely anymore that he wondered if he would even recognize it. When he checked in the trash of their bathroom, he saw that she'd taken two Percocets, prescribed to her for pain, as well as her Ativan. And he knew she had secret stashes of OxyContin, Valium, and Ambien with her at all times. But he wasn't going to waste time hunting them down. He hoped she didn't fall through a hole in the ice or get lost in the woods. That left Addison in the condo with Tess. He hadn't realized it, but Tess did not end up going along with the others. She didn't ski, though Greg had spent much of their 4-hour wine-soaked fondue dinner the night before trying to convince her to take a private lesson. Tess had been reluctant, but Greg seemed to have persuaded her in the end. And yet when Addison closed the door behind Phoebe, he stayed at the sidelight until Phoebe pulled away, wondering if it was wise even to let her drive in the snow, much less skate or ski, and returned to the kitchen to his coffee in the Wall Street Journal. There was Tess at the table, wearing a heather gray Nordic sweater and black leggings and socks, assiduously punching numbers into her cell phone again and again. "There's no reception here," she said. "Who were you trying to call?" "The kids, the babysitter." Tess smiled, then flushed, embarrassed. "I know they're fine, but..." "You're a good mother," Addison said, "and good mothers worry." She set the phone down on the kitchen table and looked at him. Really looked at him with her wide blue eyes. It took him by surprise. Thank you, she said. Thank you for saying that.
She cast her eyes down at the table. Greg thinks it's ridiculous how much I worry. But they're my children. I like to know they're okay. I like to know what they're doing, what they're eating, if they slept well, what they dreamed about.
They're lucky to have you, Addison said.
I don't want them to think I've just abandoned them the day after Christmas. And the tree is still up with the lights on it, and I told Cassidy not to build a fire, but it gets so cold in our house. So then at the last minute, I told her that if it was freezing, then it was okay for her to build a fire, and I was up half the night worried that she would build a fire and the house would burn down.
You don't have to explain it to me, Addison said. I get it.
Tess sighed. I guess I'll have to call them from town. What are you up to today?
I'm going to the fitness center right now, Addison said. Then I thought I might walk into town for some lunch.
Tess was staring at him. She was pretty, like a doll.
Of course, Phoebe was pretty, like a doll, too.
Phoebe was an exquisite china doll, delicate, fragile. Tess was pretty like a Bobbsey twin, like Marianne from Gilligan's Island. She was cute, perky, freckled, kindergarten teacher pretty.
What? He said.
I like it that you made a plan for yourself, she said. You're not worried about the others. You're not worried about Phoebe.
I'm always worried about Phoebe, he thought. But he would never say this to Tess.
You just asked yourself what you wanted to do today, and you're going to do it.
Yes, he said. I'm very selfish.
New Year's resolution is to be more selfish, Tess said. To do things that I want to do. Not that the kids want me to do or Greg wants me to do. What I realized this year, you know, is that I put far too much time and effort into looking out for Greg. And meanwhile, Greg is looking out for Greg. He's doing a terrible job, of course. Here Tess gave a weak laugh, and Addison thought, are we going to talk about it? Tess paused. She looked for a moment like she was sizing him up. Was he worthy of a conversation about the big, forbidden topic? He was not. She said, so one of the things I decided is that I'm going to spend more time and energy taking care of myself. She fiddled with her iPhone. With its yellow cover, it was as bright as a child's toy. I don't even know where to start. She glanced up. So for today, can I tag around with you? Had it started then? Getting closer? Addison filled with warmth and anticipation. Would it seem odd to the others if he and Tess spent the day together? The hallmark of these group trips had always been unexpected alliances. Addison remembered the 4-hour canoe trip he and the chief had taken during their vacation at the Point on Saranac Lake. They had gotten lost somehow, had debarked and carried the canoe over their heads like Indians until they came across a dirt road where they hitched a ride back to the Point with 2 dope-smoking hippies who seemed markedly less jolly when they discovered Ed was a police chief. That story was now legend. It remained the touchstone of Addison and Ed's friendship. So today would be his day with Tess.
I'd love it, he said.
They went to the fitness center, which was down the hill at the base of the condo complex. Addison signed them in under Jack's name. The place was deserted except for a very fit-looking older gentleman on the elliptical and a muscle-bound kid of about 25 who was wearing a complicated knee brace and pumping iron. Both the older man and the kid eyed Tess in the mirror as she stripped down to her workout clothes. A pair of incredibly flattering yoga pants and a jog bra that left the pale, toned plane of her abdomen bare. Addison wore gym shorts and the tattered gray Princeton t-shirt that he'd ordered 10 years earlier from the back of the alumni magazine. It was a revolting spectacle, according to Phoebe,
but it was the t-shirt he liked to work out in. He got on the treadmill. 40 minutes, level 7 with hills, just as he did 6 days a week at the gym. Why did he feel like a stranger to this machine? Why did he feel self-conscious and uncoordinated? Tess was on the mat in front of the mirror, stretching, or doing yoga, Addison couldn't tell. She was incredibly flexible. The young guy was watching her, too. Addison was surreptitiously watching him watching her. Okay, it was impossible to exercise this way. Addison put on his headphones and tried to keep up with the pace he'd set. He gave it more than usual. He gave it too much. He was running at a 9 with hills. He was sweating like a wild boar. The Princeton t-shirt was dark and sopping. Addison's face was red, and he was forced to remove his glasses because they kept slipping down his nose. He set them on the tray next to the Newsweek he was too pumped up even to open, but without his glasses he couldn't see Tess. Or rather, he could see her, first on the exercise bike, then doing sit-ups on the incline bench, then lifting weights and chatting with the young stud in between sets. But Addison's eyes were very bad. Everyone told him to get LASIK surgery, but he could not abide the thought of a laser or anything else touching his eye. And hence he could not see Tess's facial expression. He could not see the muscles in her stomach tense and release with the sit-ups, and he could not hear clearly what she was saying to the young stud. Blind people, apparently, had a keen sense of hearing to compensate for not being able to see, but without his eyeglasses, Addison felt completely adrift. He might as well have been up on the mountain, buried in a snowbank. He heard Tess laugh, heard her say, "Nantucket," heard her say, "Oh, that's too bad, such bad luck." Maybe this guy was telling her the reason for the knee brace. Ski accident, Addison guessed, torn ACL. It was as if Tess and the guy were speaking a foreign language, and not one of the three Addison was fluent in. Had Tess noticed him? Did she see how fast he was flying up one electronic hill after another? He realized simultaneously that he was trying to impress Tess, and that he was jealous of the kid with biceps the size of grapefruits and a sympathy-evoking knee injury. Jealous. But no, not possible. He asked himself, if some blonde, hulking Adonis on the cross-country trail decided to accompany Phoebe and then later join her for lunch, would Addison be jealous? The answer was no. Men hit on Phoebe regularly because she was so beautiful, and Addison's prevailing emotion for these men was pity. She doesn't see you, and even if she does see you, she won't let you in. She lives in a chamber where there is only enough oxygen for one. Addison got off the treadmill shakily. He was going to have a heart attack. He staggered around on the astroturf carpet, disoriented for a second about which way was up. He collapsed onto the floor and put his head between his knees. His vision was blurred. Then he realized he needed his glasses, but he didn't have the energy to stand up and retrieve them. He felt a hand on his shoulder. He looked up to see the older gentleman. "Are you okay?" the gentleman asked. There was an audible gasp in the gym. Tess set her weights down on the bench. "Addison," she said, "what's wrong?" Well, he had trumped the kid in the knee brace. But Addison wasn't after Tess's sympathy. He had wanted to be impressive. He had wanted Tess to see that although he wasn't careening down the side of a mountain at 30 miles per hour with two popsicle sticks strapped to his feet, he was still an athlete. "I'm fine," he said, smiling. He could not see her expression, though she was standing right over him. "Never better. That was a great workout." Tess said, "You sure?" "Sure, I'm sure. I'm just cooling down." "Okay," she said. "Great. I have 3 sets left. Bill is helping me with my form. He was on the ski patrol here, but he hurt his knee jumping from the lift. He was trying to rescue a little boy." Sounded like a load of shit to Addison, but he said, "Wow. Okay, I'm going to do some stretching and we'll leave when you're ready." No doubt about it. Addison was jealous. Tess giggled. "It was so cute. Bill thought you were my husband." They walked out of the fitness center into a light snow. with the fir trees and the condo units looking like alpine chalets, and the snow coming down so softly that the flakes seemed suspended in the air, it was so lovely and peaceful that when Addison spoke, he whispered so as not to disturb the silence. "Do you want to go back to the condo to shower, or should we just go for our walk?" "Let's walk," Tess said. There was a path that led out of the condo complex and headed down, parallel to the mountain road. The path was in the woods, and there were small footbridges that delivered them over tiny streams. "It will lead us into town eventually," Addison said, "and you can call your kids and we can get some lunch." Tess linked her arm through his. "You are such a prince."
"I aim to please."
They walked along 10 steps, and then 20, with Tess's arm twined through his. This, for Addison anyway, was when it began. Because this was when he started to feel like he was 14 years old. Tess's arm through his was a distraction, but he realized he would be crushed if she separated from him. But then he worried. Did she want to separate from him? This was also when Tess asked, "How is Phoebe doing?" In a grave way, as though Phoebe had cancer. And instead of giving his usual sunshine and butterfly answer of, "She's fine, great, really great," Addison expelled what felt like all the air from his lungs and said, "I just don't know." It was the honesty of his answer that opened the floodgates between them. They were going to talk, really open up, really share things about their respective marriages that they would never think of sharing with the rest of the group. He told Tess everything as they walked. It was easy. The words flowed out of him. He told her everything he would have told a therapist, but both he and Phoebe had given up hope in therapists. Addison and Tess crossed bridges and left matching sets of footprints in the snow. Addison found he couldn't talk fast enough. Addison told the truth. He said things like, "Phoebe is not the woman I married. She's changed." But that doesn't do it justice. She emigrated. She's a refugee of her grief. It has colonized her, reorganized her. She's different down to her cells, her molecules. And it's 8 years later. So it's not grief anymore. It's the drugs, the so-called medication, the substances applied to her pain. They are her captor now, and she suffers from Stockholm syndrome. She loves the drugs. They are more important to her than Reed ever was. Tess knew how to listen. Perhaps this was a result of having a classroom full of five-year-olds vie for her attention 180 days a year. She did not automatically take Phoebe's side, as Addison had expected. "Let me play devil's advocate here." She was hearing Addison's side. She was still holding on to Addison's arm. Addison said, "Our sex life is a shambles, once, twice a year, and only when she's been drinking." Tess said, "That must be difficult, to have this gorgeous woman right there in your bed and not be able to touch her." "I'm used to it," Addison said. "That is the screwed up thing. I'm used to a crippled marriage." They reached town, a charming covered bridge, a steepled church. Because it was a heavy-lidded gray day, all of the twinkling Christmas lights were on. Snow-dusted wreaths hung from lampposts. They strolled past shops with cheese and chutney, maple syrup, nutcrackers, wind chimes, pottery, wine and spirits, specialty kitchen equipment, woolen hats, gloves, scarves, sweaters. "Anywhere you want to go in?" Addison asked. "Maybe later," she said. "Want to call your kids?" he asked. "Yes," she said. She decided to call from the middle of the covered bridge, leaning on the railing, overlooking the river. "It is so liberating to be here with you. Every time I call the kids around Greg, I feel guilty, like I'm sneaking a cigarette. Ridiculous, right? Because if anyone should feel guilty, it's Greg." Addison let that comment hang for a second. Were they going to talk about it? But at that second, the babysitter answered, and Tess said, "Cassidy, hi, it's Tess. How is everything?" She was visibly lighter when she got off the phone. It's snowing at home. Cassidy is taking them to sled at Dead Horse Valley and then home to have hot chocolate and change into dry clothes. Then she's taking them for dinner and a movie at the Starlight. They'll be in bed at 8:30, which is very late, but what the heck, it's vacation. She grinned at Addison. She was wearing a red cashmere hat, and the curled ends of her dark hair poked out beneath it. She was lovely. Addison was overcome with the desire to kiss her. Kiss Tess McAvoy. He was sure he would be struck by lightning or the railing he was leaning on, indeed depending on for support, after the treadmill and 3 miles of walking his legs were shot, would give way, dumping him into the icy river. "What do you want to do now?" he asked. "Lunch," she said. It was, they agreed afterward, the lunch of a lifetime. They went to a small French cafe called Nous Deux, We Two, that had a blackboard menu and banquettes that used to be church pews and were now upholstered in bright Provençal fabrics. The woman who seated them was the owner, Sandrine, a Québécoise, Addison discovered, as he and Sandrine chatted for a moment in French. Sandrine was visibly delighted by Addison's French. He asked for a table in the corner. He and Tess each slid onto a pew, and Sandrine left them with the menus and the wine list. Tess said, "You speak French so beautifully." 6 strict years with Madame Vergineau and 2.5 years in Paris working for Coldwell. Would you like wine? Wine? She said, as if he were suggesting an all-night rave at an underground club on the Boulevard Saint-Germain. He remembered suddenly that this was Tess, who during the course of a normal week drank milk at lunch out of one of the small cartons they gave the kids. But then she said, "Sure, why not?" with a wicked little grin on her face. So really, 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 it had started then, with Tess's renegade decision to throw caution to the wind and drink wine at lunch with Addison. Addison ordered the most expensive bottle on the menu, a Merceau he positively adored, but that one could rarely find on a wine list. Ordering this wine and then praising Sandrine for the fine selections on her list incurred even more favor with this woman than speaking French had. She loved Addison and Tess. She brought them the wine, she poured it lavishly. Then she whisked away their menus and said to Addison, "Allow me." A succession of marvels came out of the kitchen. Duck confit on a gaufrette, endive stuffed with aged chèvre and a balsamic fig, a platter of petit croque monsieur, an asparagus salad topped with a quivering poached egg. Tiny ramekins of the most decadent onion soup gratiné Addison had ever tasted. Sandrine, Québécoise goddess, treated Addison and Tess not like husband and wife, but like lovers. She set plates down, she gave a sly smile or a wink, she disappeared. Tess, defying all precedent, was an accomplished student of such debauchery. She not only drank the wine, she savored it the way it was meant to be savored, mouthful by mouthful, over the tongue, eyes fluttering. Addison could not help drawing a comparison. Phoebe drank wine the way she took pills. She threw it back with purpose rather than joy, then waited for the numbness to take effect. Tess ate her food in tiny, delicate tastes. She had a child's hands. He had always been aware of this, but what he hadn't realized was how deft her hands were. Addison fumbled with his food. He was nervous, despite the loosening effect of the Merceau. But Tess cut little bites and popped them into her mouth quickly and neatly. During all this time, the wine being savored, Addison bravely ordered a second bottle. The courses devoured. Sandrine appearing, then disappearing, Tess was talking. She talked about the problems she'd had getting pregnant. The 2 miscarriages, the baby lost at 21 weeks. Then she talked about the twins. She loved the twins too much, maybe, and this was what had caused her problems with Greg. Again, Addison held his breath. Were they going to talk about it? Sandrine popped the cork on the second bottle of Merceau, and Tess reached for her glass and drank. And then she started to talk about it, that Sunday night, April Peck, What April said, what Greg said, holes in April's story, holes in Greg's story. How Tess knew Greg was lying. How she begged him to tell the truth. How he stupidly stuck by the asinine lies he concocted. Addison nodded. He tried to mirror Tess's own listening techniques. He did not defend Greg's side of the story. Instead, it felt like he had been looking through the wrong end of a kaleidoscope. Only now, when hearing the story from Tess, did it all make sense. "We've been married 11.5 years, Tess said. "Andrea tells me not to let one measly night ruin so many years of hard work and devotion. But what Andrea doesn't understand is that the one measly night was representative of so many underlying problems in our marriage. The fact that I can't get the truth. Greg won't come clean. What Andrea doesn't understand is that the hard work and devotion have been one-sided, me giving to him." She carefully constructed a masterpiece bite out of farmhouse bread, roquefort, apricot preserves, and a candied pecan. Sandrine had just dropped off a cheese plate worthy of Auguste Renoir. Tess eyed the morsel thoughtfully, then looked at Addison. She had tears in her eyes. Oh no, he thought. She was going to cry. "I want to leave him," she said.
"And go where?" Addison said. Tears dripped down her face.
"I don't know," she said. "Paris?"
It had started there. They did not need the petite tarts tatin with Calvados ice cream that Sandrine sent out, nor did they need the chocolate truffles or the slender flutes of rose champagne. "Bilicar Saint-Mont," Sandrine said. "Un cadeau," a gift. But they enjoyed them anyway. Addison paid the bill with 5 $100 bills, which made Tess gasp even louder than she had at the gym when she thought he was in cardiac arrest. He whisked her out of there, stopping only to kiss Sandrine on both cheeks and say, "Le déjeuner de ma vie." He and Tess were holding hands as they left the restaurant. Nous deux. We two. That morning at 8 o'clock, Tess McAvoy had been Phoebe's friend and, more saliently for Addison, Greg's wife. She had been a secondary or tertiary theme in the symphony of Addison's life. She had been a figure in the background.